The KYMN Climate Show is a monthly feature here on 95.1 The One and AM 1080, discussing changes in climate and the science behind it. And now, your hosts, Alan Anderson and Bruce Moreland.
Welcome to the KYMN Climate Show with Bruce Moreland and Alan Anderson, where we discuss climate issues in the news and then dig into the details in those stories. Today, we're going to be talking about changes in the Minnesota climate. But before we get to that, Bruce, what interesting stories have you found in recent weeks?
You know, Alan, almost nothing interesting happened this month except that Texas fell off the planet. What a great lesson in hubris and humility, I'll tell you what. We've all heard about the recent polar vortex and how it just decimated Texas, just hit them really hard. And we're sitting up here in our relative warmth, you know, we probably had to put on a long sleeve shirt at some point, but they were devastated. And what we learned from that is that their power grid was really set up very poorly in some sense for this kind of weather. So what did we see? Well, we saw that they were seeing wholesale prices for electricity jump like 300-fold. Okay.
Wait a minute. I thought it was 12 cents a kilowatt.
Not. When this happens, there were people that were hit with shock bills in the thousands. And what was really shocking is a lot of them had set up for automatic payment. Right? So $6,000 automatically disappears from your checking account. I think you're going to notice that, especially if you're used to like 1/300th of that.
And those variable rates are due to an unregulated market?
Well, it's a free market. It's what we free-loving people like to call a free market. And it exposes some of the issues with a completely free market system. But it's not as free as you think. But in any case, what they had been setting themselves up for is really good prices in the summer when everybody's using electricity and they were able to move it around and get the best bid, you know, and it was really, really working well. Didn't work so well in the winter. So what happened? Well, they have a market for electricity, and we'll get into a little bit of the details on that, and that market couldn't keep up with the demand for reasons that weren't related to production, but it was related to hardening, and I'll explain that when we get there. What happened, though, was that the frigid temperatures down there, which they had designed for hot temperatures, and hot temperatures mean air conditioning, and it means high demand, and they wanted to make sure they could cover that, and so they had a mixture of solar and natural gas, coal, nuclear, everything was online. They could, during the summer, they could provide electricity. But the frigid temperatures kind of dammed the flow of some of the natural gas, caused 356 electrical power generators to fail at some point during that week. And blackouts spread until they covered like 4 million households. And we've seen this kind of stuff in Minnesota, but because there was a couple years ago when we had a cold snap, remember, and they were having trouble with natural gas up north, right?
Yep.
Well, Texans found out the hard way that cold weather and gas pipelines require extra attention. So anyway, what I thought was really interesting about this was to compare the different media sources for how they covered this breaking news story. And what I saw was that the stories from the left, if you will, like the MSNBCs and the CBCs and you know, all the Canadian broadcasting. Anyway, on what I would consider left-wing publications, they wanted to focus on the failures in the natural gas and the nuclear plants, which weren't hardened to freezing temperatures, as I said. And this is in spite of a similar experience back in 1989 and in 2011. So this is not their first rodeo. I love to use that talking about Texans. This is not their first rodeo with cold weather, but they didn't learn the lessons, and things got much harder this year. So they wanted to focus on that. They wanted to focus on the families. Remember I hinted that people were paying thousands of dollars in electrical bills. They wanted to focus on that. And they were also enjoying some serious schadenfreude over the deregulated industry not being prepared.
And Bruce, schadenfreude. What is that again?
Schadenfreude. As my German grandmother used to tell me, you shouldn't be schadenfreude over this. You shouldn't be enjoying your friend's misfortunes. And that's what schadenfreude is the enjoyment of somebody else's misfortune. So anyway, lessons from me grandma. On the left, they're focusing on the deregulated industry not being prepared. And I wanted to talk a little bit more about what that is, what they really are looking at there. And they're looking at a private industry and industry designs to what's called 3 to 4 sigma planning. That's the industry standard. And that means that they're planning for, and those of you on the planning commissions will recognize these kinds of talking, a 1 in 250 chance of something happening in a year. So that's kind of a 3 or 4 sigma event, you know, that 500-year flood or that 250-year flood. And as I tell planning commissions and as we talk about this, the Climate Action Planning Advisory Board talked about this, the trick is that you can't use past performance to predict future outcomes anymore because things are changing all around us in ways that are still being investigated. We're still trying to figure out what all this is. So their private industry was a 3 to 4 sigma. It's a 1 in 250-year planning system. And they were focusing on the upper end of the distribution, which is to say hot summers. They weren't focusing on how cold it might get. And that's what caught them off guard. And that's just the difference in the way people think about things.
And one of the funny observations there is if they were planning for hotter and hotter summers, they were absolutely right about that. But they neglected to remember that climate change makes wacky weather.
Wacky weather. And in fact, I looked into that because that's one of the questions that would be obvious is, why are polar vortices, why is it getting colder sometimes? And part of the answer is because the poles are heating at different rates than the equator and our polar vortex is kept in place by the balance between the pole temperatures, the pole weather, and the equatorial weather. And if you've ever seen Jupiter or Saturn, you're struck by these big bands that go all the way around these giant planets.
Well, with swirling winds.
Yeah, well, the swirling winds are underneath that troposphere or that high air. And we forget that we can't, you know, their atmospheres are laden with nitrous oxides and all kinds of stuff that makes them very pretty and, you know, nice colors and everything. Ours, for the most part, is oxygen, nitrogen, carbon dioxide. Well, very little carbon dioxide. Mostly oxygen and nitrogen. And that makes ours pretty transparent, so we don't see those bands. But they're there nonetheless. And the polar vortex, with it being disrupted at the high latitudes, sends air south. And when it does, it gets cold where people aren't used to it that much. And we've seen this. It used to be that you could expect a good polar vortex about every other year, about once every 2 years. And it looks like, when I look at the data, that the frequency has gone up in recent times. And why is that important? Well, that's part of how you look for a change in what's going on, is you look for places where your model breaks. So if I had a model that was running at, once every 2 years, a polar vortex is going to form, and now I see that they're forming more like once a year, I have to ask, why has that changed? And the answer is because the pole air heats at a different rate than the equatorial, which means that the mixing solution models have to be changed.
And in fact, one of the things that I just read in a new study is that the Arctic and the Antarctic are heating at 4 times the rate of the equator now.
There you go. And when I say poles, I'm talking both Arctic and Antarctic.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, we don't care about... if an Antarctic polar vortex reaches us here in Minnesota, we got more going on but in any case. So science is still out on whether they're getting more frequent, but they have a causal chain that would suggest that they do, and that has to do with the differential heating rates. But the models still have to be tweaked to make sure that we understand how to incorporate that into the model. Now, I'm going to tell you about, remember I've been talking about this because their whole power grid is designed to an industry standard of 3 to 4 sigma. Meaning the once in 250 years or so mean time between events or whatever. It's really different when you look at military and government planning. And particularly military planning tends to be very conservative, and some government planning is very conservative. And the way it's conservative is they either own the output process or they mandate that the output process be hardened against extreme events. Now, I'm going to go back to the Climate Action Planning Advisory Board, where we had conversations about should we be recommending that the city have their planning deal with 1,000-year floods, because 1,000-year floods are becoming 100-year floods. Remember we talked about that?
We did.
Yes. Well, did we make any progress on that?
The recommendation went forth.
The recommendation.
We'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens. Well, in Texas, the recommendation must have been shelved someplace.
Yeah.
But the reason I'm talking about that is military and governments plan for once in a, you know, 3.4 million odds. So those are really rare events. What in financial terms you often hear called black swans. And those low probability events, why are they important?
Because they can be devastating if they show up.
Exactly. When it comes knocking at your door, you don't want to be using that time to figure out whether to put in hard doors or soft doors. You want to have the door appropriate to the situation. And that's what Texas didn't have. Now, what did they gain from their deregulated industry? On average, they were getting lower prices because it was very competitive and it was very robust. And because of the way they planned, like I said, they were planning for warm summers. So they were doing all right on that model. But when you look at what really went on, I've talked now about how the left looked at it. Let's talk about how the right looked at it. The stories from the right, can you guess what they focused on?
Let's see, frozen windmills.
Frozen windmills, exactly right. Now, in Minnesota, our wind turbines are cold hardened, but that's because we experience cold weather. Texans didn't think like that, so theirs weren't cold hardened. But I'm sure that anybody who follows just one side of the media spectrum, the right side, saw the images of helicopters spraying an ice-covered wind turbine, right? Remember, you've probably seen that picture.
Yep.
It's not a fake picture. It's not a Photoshop. But it's from a test in Sweden in 2014, not Texas in 2021. But it's a nice picture, and it allows you to make all kinds of snarky comments, which it turns out if you do the math are not correct. But, you know, when you're into snarky comment territory, what are you going to do? So anyway, when you see that helicopter spraying on an ice-covered turbine, just recognize that was from a test. It's not routine, and it's not what everybody's doing. And what everybody does is they plan for blowing ice off the turbines. They plan for the because what's wrong? I don't know if you've ever tried to start your summer car in a cold, cold, cold January, and it goes, right, right? And that oil gets thick. Well, happens to wind turbines, too. That oil gets thick up there, and if you don't have a heating element in there, like we have in Minnesota for our, you know, you used to plug your car in all the time. Modern cars, you don't have to as much. But in the old days, you'd have extension cords and plug in your car and the things we did. Anyway, and part of the problem there is what we want to believe overrules what's actually being reported, especially if we're only listening. We have two ears for a reason, Alan. We have two ears for a reason. That's so you will hear from both sides and two eyes. Well, I don't focus left and right that way, but anyway, you get my point.
Just a fun analogy there, some Native American wisdom. You know, if you only have the right wing or the left wing, you only have one of them, you can't fly.
That's right. You have to have both wings to fly. So, anyway, the real story was that most of the supply that went offline and caused the problem was, interestingly, coal and natural gas, not wind. Now, why is that? Well, it's because wind was only 10 or 15% of the total production anyway, and it dropped a little bit. But when I look at this graph that shows what was going on, it turns out that natural gas and coal both went offline early, I think, on the 15th, right? And you can see a huge drop in supply because of those two dropping. And then solar didn't really drop all that much. In fact, it didn't even show up at that point. And wind dropped just a little bit. So most of the loss was due to natural gas, and their problem was delivery. Apparently, the natural gas lines were, you know, it's the same thing with a diesel truck in the north. You have to pay attention to the fuel because it won't flow and it won't vaporize unless you preheat it. So people that do this stuff for a living know that. People that live in Texas apparently hadn't learned that lesson. Oh, anyway, it's really interesting, too, on this chart. You can see where the nuclear plant dropped out. And you'd think a nuclear plant would be pretty robust, but if you have cooling systems that rely on liquids that don't flow well when it's cold, you got a problem. All right.
And we'll be posting that graph online.
Yep. It's a great graph to look at. It's really fun because it shows solar showing up like the white knight on the horizon. Dun, 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 dun. All right. Anyway, so that was the story that I got out of that.
All righty. And I've got a fun short story, and the headline is "A Clean Energy Milestone: Renewables Pull Ahead of Coal in 2020. So, as I think most people know, coal production has been declining, mainly because it's been being beaten down economically by natural gas. And wind and solar have been rising, and all of the renewables together, wind, solar, hydro, and so forth, overtook coal in the number of gigawatt hours produced in 2020. And interestingly, renewables also overtook nuclear energy. So in 2020, nuclear produced about, excuse me one second here, I've lost my graph.
I could loan you mine, it won't do you any good. But.
Oh, here we go. Nuclear produced about 800 gigawatts. Coal produced a little less than that. And renewables produced a little more than that, 800 gigawatts. So renewables have caught up with both coal and nuclear, but natural gas is still way up there, mainly because of the invention of fracking and cheap natural gas, which has caused gas to replace coal. And it's pretty dramatic, though. One of the reasons that renewables are growing so quickly is that in the case of solar energy, in 2009, it cost $360 per megawatt hour to produce by solar. But by 2020, that $360 per megawatt became $37 per megawatt, a decrease of almost 90% in the price just since 2009.
Wow.
It's pretty dramatic. And it's anticipated that some of those gains are going to be continuing. So it's pretty exciting.
Now, as natural gas has been replacing coal, that gives us two benefits, right? The first benefit is it's cheaper, which is good. And the second benefit is it doesn't produce as much CO2 per megawatt. Is that right?
That's correct. And in fact, it when you're actually burning it to produce energy, it only produces about half as much CO2 as burning coal for the same amount of energy. The complication, of course, and everything is complicated, even though we wish it wasn't, all of the methane leakage along the mining and whole supply chain, the methane leakage is fairly substantial. And methane is actually about a 30 times more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2.
Yep.
So natural gas, while we like to say it's a clean alternative to coal, that's only half true. Yep. And we eventually have to get off natural gas also.
Yep. And it's kind of ironic that we used to see, probably still see, oil wells burning off the natural gas because it was cheaper to burn it off than it was to try and bottle it.
Right.
That's just amazing to me. And I you know, that's...
So, Bruce, what's your third story?
Well, my third story is an interesting... The Citizens Climate Lobby has been proposing for probably a decade and a half now, a carbon fee and dividend, a border-adjusted, right... carbon fee and dividend. And what that means is when you cross the border, you pay money or you get money depending on which direction you're going and if you don't have a carbon fee in your own country. And we always talk about that border adjustment being an important part of why it's bipartisan, because it means that we're keeping the free market economics running. But it turns out that as we're getting into this new generation or this new administration, we're seeing that we might end up with a carbon fee and dividend that's not bipartisan. And we've been having a discussion about whether it can stand or not. And I think that bipartisanship is so important to that carbon fee and dividend bill that I am throwing myself on my sword over this one. And that's why I work with Braver Angels, for example. But one of the stories I can now take to a Republican member of Congress is that Canada already has a carbon fee and dividend with a border adjustment. And I happen to know a guy who's a good conservative in Braver Angels, and he has a story. And his personal story is when he drives a truckload of glass, like you make windows out of, when he drives a truckload of glass into Canada out of Minnesota, he has to write a check at the border to pay the Canadians for the privilege of bringing in this because he doesn't pay a carbon fee at home.
And that's the border adjustment.
That's the Canadian border adjustment hitting his pocketbook. He's taking American money and giving it to the Canadian people. Uh-huh. And now it turns out that the EU, the European Union, without Britain, of course, is proposing their own carbon fee and dividend also with a border adjustment. So now when we're shipping stuff into Europe, we'll be writing checks with American money to go to European citizens. And I am just so annoyed by that. I really want to explain that to Republican Congress people so that they can understand that that border adjustment is already impacting us. And the reason the border adjustment is important is why? Because it does enforce that policy on China. So when China brings a truckload or a boatload of stuff to the border and writes a big fat check to the American people, that's a good thing.
Indeed.
But what's even more important is if we go the old school way, what was the old school way of solving the climate problem? We'll just give money to the industries. We'll pick our winners and losers, and we'll say we like Solyndra. We'll give them $100 million. You know, we pay for it here. But where does that money often end up going? Often ends up going to China because they're the ones that produce the stuff that make those renewables work. So we need to think about that, whether we really want to continue to try and pick winners and losers with taxpayer money that goes to China, or would we rather put in a good carbon fee and dividend and collect money from the Chinese goods as they come into the country. I think it's a no-brainer. But
I think it's a no-brainer, too.
I can't wait to get to sit in a congressperson's office and talk to him about that as a good conservative.
There you go. So my fourth story is just entitled Make It Stop. And this is actually good news. And I know that for some of you regular listeners, sometimes you wonder where the good news is. Well, here's some really good news. Scientists have discovered that there is less warming in the pipeline than we thought after we reach net zero emissions. It used to be believed that because of the atmosphere and the size of the heat sink in the oceans, that once we brought CO2 emissions down to net zero, we would still have maybe an entire half a degree Celsius built in to the system. So we'd stop emissions, but we'd still get an additional half a degree, which is a lot. But the good news is that new research shows that that's likely not true. And climate scientists are now confident that when we bring emissions to net zero, that temperature increases will level off and stop increasing. And this is really very good news in our battle to not overheat our climate. Now, it is important to remember, though, that once we get to net zero and we can level off, temperature increases, we will be stuck with whatever wacky weather, heat waves, melting ice we have at that temperature where we level off. So we're still faced with the challenge that we have to bring down CO2 in the atmosphere if we're going to get back to the stable climate that we've enjoyed in the past.
And let me just add on top of that that agriculture is part of how we're going to bring that CO2 back down. And part of the lag in the system is that we're still going to melt the ice caps enough that they will continue to release more and a darker ocean. So we'll still have some issues with absorption and all that.
Yep.
But it is good news. It's exciting news, and it gives me hope.
So
Wait a minute. Just real quick, let me remind you that you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1, broadcasting out of Northfield, Minnesota. This is The Climate Show with your hosts, Bruce Moreland and Alan Anderson. And today we're talking about how Minnesota moved south to Missouri.
And you're saying, wait a minute, I haven't heard anything about Minnesota yet. Well, that's the next segment. So, Minnesota, of course, has been studying what's happening in our own state. The DNR and the Pollution Control Agency and so forth have been, and our agriculture experts have been studying what's happening. And it's pretty interesting. Minnesota actually has been warming faster than a lot of the other states. Now, that doesn't mean, for example, that we're getting hotter than Florida, but where Florida maybe only warms up 1 degree above their averages, Minnesota has actually warmed up almost 3 degrees Fahrenheit above our prior averages.
That's because we're much closer to the pole where it's warmed by 4 degrees.
That has a lot to do with it, actually. And interestingly, 10 of the warmest and wettest years on record in the state of Minnesota have been in just the last 20 years. And average temperatures, as I mentioned, have gone up nearly 3 degrees Fahrenheit since 1895. And winter nights have gone up almost 5 degrees. And then you shift over to that wetter portion. There's been a 20% increase in the number of one-inch rains, a 65% increase in the number of three-inch rains, and almost a four-fold increase, a 400% increase in the number of six-inch rains in the last three decades over prior averages. And if you're a farmer, of course, those rains aren't coming gently. They're coming in torrential downpours that can wash away crops, flood fields, and really make a mess of things. So it's too wet to plant in the spring, or it might be your crops might be too wet to harvest in the fall. It's really causing a lot of challenges for our farmers. So the big takeaway mainly is Minnesota is getting warmer and wetter, and it's anticipated that we will have increases in temperature and precipitation continuing through the rest of this century unless we really make an impact on rising CO2. And then from the DNR, some other observations. We're having winter freeze-up coming later and winter ice out in the spring coming earlier. And that means that the ice fishing and ice recreation is all getting shorter. And that impacts actually a billion-dollar industry.
And then, Alan, I have a quick question for you. By the end of this century means that my grandkids are going to be confronting this as they're entering the peak part of their life for earning and jobs. And they're going to have to deal with a world that is completely changed from where it is right now.
Yep. Unless we grown-ups now decide that some small sacrifice on our part, and a quick sidebar there, I think of the sacrifices that immigrant families make, both in the 1800s and still today, the sacrifices that immigrants make to get to the United States, to build a home, to get their kids educated so that their kids can have a better life. And when you think of those huge sacrifices of even our own immigrant parents, surely we can make some sacrifices now so that our offspring can even have a shot at a decent life in a world with a friendly climate. But back to the DNR. A lot of Minnesotans love fishing for walleye, but walleye are clean, cold water fish. And the more we warm up, the more lakes will warm up, and the more difficult time walleyes will have in natural reproduction. And so if you're a walleye fisherman, you ought to be all over wanting to bring climate change to a halt.
And I presume you're aware that Bridgewater Township is fighting furiously to protect a natural breeding ground for brown trout right here in Rice County.
Yes, indeed.
That's another cold water fish.
Another cold water
fish. Cold and clear.
Depends completely on it being cold and clear. And the DNR also talks about the whole maple syruping, which is a big industry in Minnesota, is being thrown out of whack by the fact that the sap starts running much earlier than it used to, in some areas a month earlier than it used to.
Didn't anybody tell these trees that they're supposed to wait until we're ready for them?
Yeah.
What's up with that?
Yep. And then also an entomologist, a bug specialist who works for the DNR, talks about the fact that our old bitterly cold winters used to kill off a lot of the insects in the winter. But now warmer weather is allowing eastern lark beetles and pine bark beetles to overwinter and come out in abundance in the spring and wreak havoc on our forests. So it's pretty challenging. And so those are some of the big things that are happening. One of the other articles that I've read recently is that there's a prediction that if we stay on the track that we're on right now, with steadily rising global average temperatures, which will mean even warmer in Minnesota, that eventually, if we don't counteract this, we will end up with ice-free lakes in the winter. And that will change everything and in a way that we don't want it to change. And yeah. People may scoff at that, but actually that's the trend that's already being recorded. So you can choose to not believe the evidence that is right before our eyes day after day if you look at the global picture, or you can deny it, but denying it certainly won't help our future at all.
Not at all. Well, it's pretty frightening to think about all these changes coming at us. So, but that's what we're here for, is to make sure that we're all aware of what's going on. We don't want to be the ostrich with our head in the sand.
Indeed.
Indeed. So for links to today's shows, please see the KYM website and look under programs for the Climate Show. Also, feel free to send us your questions at climateshow@kymnradio.net, and we'll try and get back to you with answers, or we'll answer on the air.
And next month, on April the 7th at 11, we'll be discussing the good economics of electric vehicles, so don't miss it.
That's right, that's right. So, Climate Willing and the Glaciers Don't Run, we'll be here next month with another edition of The Climate Show.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the KYMN Climate Show, airing the first Wednesday of every month here on 95.1 FM and AM 1080. Your hosts have been Bruce Moreland and Alan Anderson. Copies of today's show are available for podcast at kymnradio.net.